You're listening to an OTB AM podcast. You can watch the show or listen live every weekday morning at 7:45 AM. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream for more stuff just like this. And a very good morning. You're welcome along to Thursday morning's OTB AM. We're live and in glorious technicolor across all our social platforms. And if you just want to listen to us, you can log on to offtheball.com and hit the listen live button, minimise us. And we are breakfast radio in your ears every morning, talking nothing but sport and some Game of Thrones, hot Game of Thrones action. Ah, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I do want to just tease out a little bit more about your weekend. Just a quick reminder for anybody who's just joining us today, Owen took Monday off to celebrate Kerry's victory.
And then obviously
it was a funeral that they were having in the aftermath of Kerry's defeat against Mayo. But you've got history with the Mayo fans, which we didn't bring up yesterday. So your history with the Mayo fans is that you've been fighting with them on multiple occasions.
That's not true.
Mates of yours have been sucked into a little bit of argy-bargy in the terraces.
Not true, really.
Like, not 100% true, right?
Argy Bargy's stretching it a little bit. There may or may not have been an incident last year in Castlebar, but that was
strong words.
Exactly, strong words. Tensions were high that day. It was Johnny Sexton's drop goal. It was a great win for Kerry on that occasion.
Finger jabbing,
yeah. And, like,
hands on.
There was basically... I'm just actually kind of remembering what actually happened on that occasion. There was a couple of words said about the referee, and then there was kind of like a little committee of Mayo fans who walked across their massive stand in Castlebar and was like, "Your behaviour was an absolute disgrace.
To your
mate.
You should
be ashamed of yourself."
Or to you?
Not to me. God, no. I'm very respectful on these occasions. And there wasn't actually anything at that level on Sunday, so it led me to believe that instead of being really, really bad losers, Mayo have just become really, really good winners, and they've got used to actually winning games.
So they weren't giving out to you and your cohorts?
No. I would have been interested to see if they had been, had Kerry actually won on that occasion.
Because your buddy was doing exactly the same thing that he was doing at the time when the Mayo fans felt the need to walk over.
I don't want to comment on Fergal Kelly's performance on the weekend. There may have been a bit of shouting here and there. It is also Thursday, by the way, and you're talking about last weekend.
I know, yeah, but this bit of it, we hadn't dragged out your bad behaviour into the public eye once more.
My behaviour was exceptional. I actually made the big screen on Sunday.
Oh, did you?
Yeah,
I was. What did you do? Did you, like, turn around and kiss wherever you went?
I actually didn't notice myself. I got a few texts afterwards. I was actually leaning across, chatting to somebody, telling them that there was a spare seat over here. So that was my moment. And TG Cahir put up their little Allianz banner right in front of my face. So I was there, and then suddenly they actually tried to remove my head off the screen, which kind of says all you need to know. A terrible day all in all, I think it's fair to say.
Nathan Murphy has a 20-minute Conor Murray interview coming up this evening on tonight's Off the Ball on News Talk. We just want to play you this clip. Here he is talking about the pressure to perform with Ireland. Have a look.
You'd be lying if you said anything different. Yeah, you probably, that's the challenge. You know, I suppose part of my game and what I pride myself on a little bit is just staying composed in the moment and staying composed enough in a pressure situation where you can make the right decision. And you know, at times this season I've been frustrated with the way I've reacted because it takes me off task and I kind of get like I said distracted about what I'm trying to do at the moment. So
do you do much work in that? Do you, like,
yeah,
talking to Enda McNulty when you're around the Irish camp, or maybe other people you talk to?
Yeah, I know Enda well. Chat to him whenever I feel the need to. Same with the coaches, with Joe and Andy and Simon and Richie. You chat to them, and you might go through a clip and say, like, what are you thinking here? You know, if you remain calm here, you might have been able to see a different option or whatever. So I think, in a weird way, it's a kind of been an enjoyable challenge to see can you remain composed when things aren't going so well. So yeah, I suppose when we got into the season a bit, and there was a few frustrations, and you could see it coming out a little bit, then you know, trying to address it and try and remain calm and try and have a positive, your next action be positive and help yourself and help the team in a good way is probably that challenge. So yeah, you know, this is the first time, you know, this amount of pressure has come on the Irish team, come on me as an individual. So it's about bouncing back from that. And look, there were moments in the Six Nations where I was really happy with. There was moments that I was frustrated with that I'm trying to work on. And you know, Saturday came through. Saturday, I was pretty happy with my game. So hopefully, it continues. You know, I want to get back to that level. I know I'm able to play it.
Got a full 20 minutes of that goodness coming your way this evening on Off the Ball with Nathan. they're all. So Robbie Henshaw's in the papers today as well, talking about you know, he was watching on obviously because he was injured for the Six Nations. But they're all kind of talking about this pressure a lot. It's like it's become this. We've talked ourselves into the fear and loathing that we experience in the Six Nations, and we're talking ourselves into a spiral and tailspin.
Well, that's good that that's happening right now. That we get the spiral and tailspin out of the way right now.
What if it lasts for the whole year? I don't like this whole, oh, it's grand, we're getting this out of our way now. I mean, are we? Where's the evidence for that? Where's the evidence for that?
I guess there's a certain sense of shock that comes from, A, some of the performances. Yeah. England, in particular Wales, away from home, I don't know, what was the lack of performance a little bit more forgivable? Either way, two terrible performances. Both of those were shocking. But also, the Dan Levy injury, I think, for me, actually kind of put things into a bit of a 2015 prism once again. It's like, it doesn't matter how many players you got lined up.
Yeah.
If your top-level talent is getting injured, you are going to bear the brunt of it. Mm. And ultimately, on a practical level, you've got Joe Schmidt, who's got months and months now to actually prepare for who is going to fill in that position and who's going to be backup and who's going to be backup to the backup. But also, in their psyche, the whole shock of actually having one of your best players out for the entire tournament is going to be lessened by the time we get to Japan. And I wonder if that's going to help things along a little bit. Like, we're getting this out of our system now. It's not going to get worse, I dare say. Like, both Munster and Leinster have got to the Champions Cup semi-finals. Once Munster won on Saturday, we knew that then that there wouldn't be a performance hangover into the Champions Cup, because I was a little bit afraid going into last weekend that, you know, Munster would get knocked out, and obviously in the other situation, we always had the banker of one of the provinces getting through, so it was never going to go wrong. I don't know, I'm a little bit more hopeful than you seem to be.
I can't see any way that Dan Levy's injury makes you feel hopeful. I mean, I get the point that you're making, it's happened now. We've got a long time to prepare for what's happening, but we can't replace Dan Levy. That's the main problem I have at the minute. And
in terms of form, though, I completely buy his idea that his performance was good on Saturday, that he can play his way back into form.
Yeah.
And ultimately, hopefully, he's got two big Munster games, huge Munster games, and who knows how they go into Pro 14 as well before the end of the year.
Yeah, look, I don't think that I don't really have any worries about the form of our 9 and 10 that everybody's so annoyed about. It's that our pack gave them not great service, and loads of other things happened as well. They didn't have. It turns out Robbie Henshaw is really important for this team, or it turns out that at 12, 13 Axis needs to be a bit more creative than it was in the Six Nations, and that having Robbie Henshaw there is going to be important for us. So, look, I'm not as worried about the individuals. It's just that the notion that somehow it's good that we're playing badly at the minute, because it's not playing badly.
Nobody's
at the
saying
World
that.
Cup. Well, it's good that we're getting this out of our system. It's good that it's happening now. That's just, you know.
Yeah.
It's just, no. Yeah,
it's definitely better that it's happening now than in October.
Yeah, but it's not cause and effect. We don't get it out of our system. You don't just kind of say, I'm done being.
You kind of do, though. Like, I mean, it's not that there is a finite amount of bad performances in a team. That's not what I'm saying. But there is a reaction to this, which will help them react to the next setback they have.
Let me compare and contrast your response to how the Kerry footballers are going with the Ireland team. You made the pronouncement that Kerry won't win an All-Ireland this year, that they're much further behind as a result of having seen them play against Mayo the last couple of times, and yet you're somehow hopeful that Ireland are going to massively improve between now and their bad performances versus what we would expect in September, October time.
There's a pretty seismic difference between the two teams. Ireland coming off the back of their greatest every year in rugby versus a Kerry team who got schooled by a mediocre Galway team in Croke Park last year, a Galway team that having a prayer of winning in All-Ireland. So that's where Kerry are at. They're in with the crowd that having a prayer of winning in All-Ireland. So they made a step forward this year. Next year is their year. The age profile is much younger than the Ireland rugby team. And like they don't have... like the comparison would be if Kerry had like Brian Fenton and Jack McCaffrey in their team, or like any of the two. Like having a world player of the year in Johnny Sexton, having an unbelievable year last year, like that's not, you're not comparing like with like there. Very different situations.
Well, the point is that like somehow this form is going to disappear and this other form is the form that's the real form.
But like that's not, I'm basing the idea that form can return based on real things. I'm not just going out on a limb here saying, well, hopefully it's going to be okay in the end. We've seen this team do a lot better. We've seen these players play at a world-class level and go toe-to-toe with the best teams in the world. That gives me hope.
Well, yeah, look, it's an interesting question to ask. What are people's realistic expectations of how Ireland are going to get on in the World Cup at the moment, and at what level of hope do they have after watching the Champions Cup performances? You can drop us a text on the hashtag OTBAM on any of our social channels. I'm going to tell you what's coming up on the show this morning. Really busy show for you. Kieran Donnelly's going to join us with the shot clock around about 8:10. We'll bring you through the newspapers in just a moment. We've got the sports news around about 8:35 with Tom. Michael Obafemi is going to join us at 8:40 for a studio interview about a whirlwind start to his career and the injury difficulties that he's been having. And then Donal O'Neill is, of course, one of the founders of the GPA, but at the moment is better known as a documentary maker. And he's got a really interesting documentary on the go about cardiac screening, and this involves the legendary Meath and Down team from 1991 to see who is the fittest team at the moment. They're doing cardiac screening. There's a special screening documentary this week as well. And then Aintree 2019 kicks off today. John Duggan's going to come in and try and win us some money with some tips. That's coming your way a little bit later on as well. So now, time for the papers. Going to start with the Irish Times. There's a match report from the Spurs game last night. Sorry, there's a match report there from the City game. It's obviously the lead. Business as usual, City counter to a predictable home victory. The Spurs match reports are the ones that lead all of the English newspapers because everybody's a Spurs fan who runs the London newspaper football coverage. FAI officials are asked to join Delaney at Oireachtas hearing. This was the news that we broke yesterday on the show when Fergus O'Dowd told us that they weren't happy with the attendees that are coming from the FAI to the Oireachtas committee next week, that they wanted a bunch of board members as well. And then in Land of Endless Yak, Tracy's silence says most. This was when John Tracy was asked to express confidence in the board of the FAI at yesterday's Oireachtas hearings and couldn't do it.
The Times Ireland edition this morning leads with Tracy won't say he backs board of FAI. We must learn from the All Blacks then, says Robbie Henshaw. He's been watching All or Nothing New Zealand All Blacks. It's Amazon Prime's behind the scenes documentary, and learning from it in terms of how to deal with the favourites tag, because that's something Ireland clearly didn't do this year in the Six Nations, while Conor Murray is saying he'll get back to his best.
The Irish Independent this morning, Cork club plan would be beginning of the end. This is the Club Players Association coming out against the Cork plan. Although obviously it didn't, I mean, it's too late, right? So Micheál Brady was responding to the Cork proposal, which is the clubs in the county who played two matches without their county players in the championship. But it was voted down, obviously, on Tuesday night. So the other part of this story, which is interesting, is Rory O'Connor from Wexford, 20, says that he thinks by the time he retires, players coming into inter-county GAA will end up being paid. Brian Cody's been hit with a double blow ahead of next month's Leinster Senior Hurling Championship. Killian Buckley and James Maher are unlikely to play any part for Kilkenny in the round robin series. It's getting to that point now where we're actually only 5 weeks away from the start of the Hurling Championship, and the games start, they come with like a bang, particularly in Munster. And the Murray backs Blaendahl step up for Munster and Ireland. So Tyler Blaendahl, obviously, in the continuing absence of Joey Carberry, Tyler Blaendahl may well be our 10, our second 10 at the World Cup.
When does he become available? June, is it?
He's already, is he not?
Oh, he's of course, it was the injuries that prevented him from getting involved, wasn't it?
Qualified in 2018, yeah.
Back page of the Irish Daily Star is Home Sweet Home, Sun Gets Spurs Party Started. So they haven't actually come up with a name for the stadium yet. Is there going to be like a Twitter poll and Stadium X Stadium Face gets voted as the name for the stadium? De Gea, De Gonner, Manchester United are ready to risk losing David De Gea for nothing next summer after failing to agree a new contract with the Spaniard. That'll be a massive loss. And Tracy Ashour, FAI will show. He's talking about the FAI and their request to appear before the Oireachtas Committee on Sport next week.
It's going to be Cashy McCashpants. That's what Spurs will sell it to. Smiles ahead. City ease past Cardiff to go back on top. Kevin De Bruyne, pretty good at football, it turns out. Man City really ruining the drama by going a goal up in the first 10 minutes of every game they play at the moment.
Yeah.
Fulham at the weekend. Last night, it's like, okay, yeah, oh, real drama here. Let's flick over and see what's going on with Spurs. A new structure, a step towards restoring cut and thrust of Cork Championship. So Donal O'Grady comes out in favour of the reforms. Tommy Martin, heaven is being a young Limerick hurler. Praise for Heung-min Son. And then Blaendahl can steer Munster ships, says Conor Murray. So obviously Conor Murray is doing the Browns in the papers today.
The back page of the Mirror is Flying Start, the flying beside Leroy Sané's head. City stroll to the top with a win to turn heat on Klopp and then start beside Heung-min Son's head. Spurs begin life in new stadium with fireworks and vital victory.
Yeah, the stadium looks pretty amazing. It's the type of stadium that is being heralded as the best stadium in the Premier League and the best sports stadium, therefore, in London and beyond, and the type of one that people will actually make a journey to go and see the stadium. So we haven't really, you know, I really have to go and see the Etihad or the Emirates, like, not really, or the London Stadium, definitely not, because the atmosphere is crap. But this one, you're like, actually, I wouldn't mind seeing this.
Yeah, I don't know, Henry Winter is like, comparing the South Stands to one of the instant classic when it comes to an end at a stadium. So is it like the Wall in Dortmund? You need to kind of be there to appreciate it. It has struck me that I do kind of want to go and see a team play there. Maybe not Spurs, but I do want to see it.
Arsenal fan dying to see Spurs Stadium. Sun in a billion, Tottenham home win. Spurs 2, Palace 0. Rory can see Cash of the Ash. There you go. Rory O'Connor believes GAA pay-for-play is on its way sooner rather than later, and I'll be Oba the injury for Danes is Michael Obafemi is going to be fit. Son's happy homecoming is the front of the Telegraph.
The Daily Mail goes at welcome home. Son and Eriksen fireworks light up Spurs' new ground. While David Snaith is writing that Tracy declines to offer backing to FAI board.
Racing Post, Entry Mania, and they have Faugheen, Bouverdere, Clan des Oboes, Bristol Demi. Do you know what they're doing? Entry Mania. Come on. What do they got? What's going on here?
This is
show
like
us panic face, please. Close up on Owen's panic face.
I'm absolutely chilled out here.
What's going on here? What's the cover? What are they channeling?
They're channeling their inner. Come on, fill in the blank.
You know it. Entry Mania. Where's Entry?
Entry is just outside Manchester. Is it Liverpool? Beatle Mania.
Hey, welcome.
I can't believe it. Yeah. I've been told Entry is like a good starter pack for kind of casual racing fans. As in, it's just as good to go drinking there all day as it is to go watch the racing. And the racing is top quality as well.
Oh, yeah.
As in Cheltenham, you're kind of like, you need to be able to not only bluff, but you need to actually be very knowledgeable and wise about racing to handle yourself there.
I think, by all accounts, Entry is there's a bang of the Kentucky Derby off it.
Not sure if that's a positive or a negative.
Oh, no, it's decadent and depraved.
All right, nice one. That is positive. Back page of the Herald is City turn up heat on Reds. Champs go top by one as Spurs open their new stadium with a win. And then finally, the Guardian. Home sweet home, they say. Sun shines for Spurs and perfect start to life at new stadium.
Okay, so some stories from the newspapers. You want to start with a profile of Mike Dean because, you know, there's not enough Mike Dean in our lives. Oh, and you want to bring some more. You want to drag this out into the light and just reveal his true character to us all.
Do you remember Peter Walton?
No.
Premier League ref. He's got a column in the Times Ireland edition this morning saying, we should celebrate Dean the way he celebrates goals, which is always a great headline to start Mike Dean. So, of course, he got his 100th red card in the Premier League the other night.
Notched, I think.
Dished out his 100th. It's time to take our hats off to Mike Dean and applaud, says Peter Walton this morning. So Mike, who's now 50 years old, looking well for 50, will not have been aware that he was one dismissal away from his century, but he was alerted to the fact. I think Mike Dean was very aware of the fact that he was on 99.
Scrawled out in blood on the wall of his jacket at home.
This is a guy, says Peter Walton, whose idea of a great weekend is to referee a Premier League match and then have a round of golf on the Sunday. He plays off a single finger handicap and was a caddy on the Ladies European Tour in 2015 for Sophie Walker at the Helsingborg Open. Something I did not know. Top caddy, Mike Dean. I like the way people kind of talk about Mike Dean's body language and how he's always kind of taking the piss out of for that. But Walton is kind of speaking about it in a very positive term, saying that he's not afraid to show his sense of humour and character in the field. Just look at the way he celebrates goals and his pronounced hand signals after he has made big decisions. When you make a great decision, you get a warm glow inside. Some people have to punch the air or clench their fist, and he is one of those people. And apparently he's a very funny man. He says his one-liners in discussion groups are legendary. He is a very sharp-witted and intelligent guy, and you have to be very careful what you say around Mike Dean, which I'm sure goes for some of the players as well. So congratulations to Mike Dean on a great caddying career, great refereeing career. 100 not out.
Yeah, I mean that's all you want, isn't it? We should talk a little bit more about this Spurs Stadium. Why have you finally got convinced? The pictures. It wasn't the opening ceremony. It wasn't the. It wasn't any of that stuff. It was actually. It looks like it's a great stadium. Yeah. It's like there's everywhere is a good view. It's got a weird kind of different. Imagine if the Aviva had the other side finished, right? It would definitely be one of the best stadiums in the world. It's got this cool. Looks like a floating spaceship thing. It's just that they forgot to finish one side of it.
Yeah, I don't think
they've managed to finish the four sides of this stadium. It took a while, but they got it done.
Like, is the Aviva Stadium in terms of being like? I don't think that would bring it up to a par with this if it just had four sides. Like, it would be a start for sure.
I mean, who knows?
Eiffel Stadium.
But that fourth side could be really steep. It could be a wall.
Yeah. Maybe.
And we put all the away fans in there and they get a massive advantage, you know.
But apparently they have deliberately gone very, very steep with this to make the sound reverberate a little bit more in the Spurs Stadium. The screens are the largest in Western Europe, and Alison Rudd saying this morning that perhaps they're a little bit too big. I think the Spurs fans themselves got a little bit intimidated last night. The Crystal Palace chanting, can you hear Tottenham saying, is this the Emirates? They were asking as they were chanting. So it'll probably take a little bit of time for the Spurs fans themselves to actually get used to it. It's a stadium from the future. We haven't seen the likes of it on these islands at any point recently. And apparently, according to to football writers, it makes the Emirates look archaic. It makes Anfield look archaic. Although there's a certain charm to that. I really want to go and I really want to just see this thing. And it seems to combine the idea of being futuristic with the kind of old school ability of a stadium to make an atmosphere great.
Yeah, I mean, stadiums like Anfield being archaic, happy days. That's the whole point. That's why they have tradition and stuff. It's like, if you're going to build a new one, what's the Emirates like?
Grand.
There you go. That's exactly what you don't want. You want it to be absolutely sensational and stunning if it's going to be new, as opposed to, oh, yeah, every view is the same and every toilet is the same and every concession is the same, overpriced and expensive.
Mm. Very plastic, I would say. Like, maybe it seems that it could be perfectly fit in with an NFL stadium. It seems that that's what it's based on. It seems that they've just taken the American model and just implanted it into North London.
Yeah, I saw Miguel Delaney, who had a tour of it this week, was tweeting about the fact that it had been heavily influenced by some of the NFL stadiums. I mean, like, they keep building new NFL stadia. Obviously, there's only 32 teams, so one of them is probably constantly being moved or upgraded or whatever. But the one in Atlanta looks pretty amazing from the outside. It's kind of got that kind of like weird steel and silver stuff. This is at least an architectural. There's been some thought put into this, as opposed to let's put four sides of a stadium up. I mean, there's a charm to Sunderland doing it for whatever it was, hardly any money, and ours ended up costing $500 million. Like, you know, what's the big deal?
Ours was basically a three-sided Allianz Arena. If they were building it now,
Allianz Arena also very cool.
Yeah,
I've been there. That's nice.
Like, is it cool in the sense of kind of flashy, cool amenities, or as in nice as in atmosphere-wise?
I don't know if I was at a game there. I can't actually remember. I think it might have been, but I presume it's good for, like, it's well designed, it looks nice outside.
What else do you want? Apparently it was like a scene from Minority Report of Blade Runner, futuristic films that are meant to unsettle us, being in the stadium last night, which is a good line. Like, if you get unsettled by a piece of architecture, it's probably a good piece of architecture.
Yeah, totally. News reaches us from Rochdale that they have a new manager.
Mm-hmm.
Brian Barry Murphy,
yeah,
cutting his teeth. He's been the stand-in manager for the last while as they've been battling against relegation, but he did so well, four games, two wins, two draws, that they're now just in relegation trouble as a function of goal difference. And so there you go. He's 40. He's been at the club since 2010 and they've handed him around. That's a very long time, isn't it? He's young, hungry for success and extremely talented, said the chairman, Andrew Kilpatrick, which is lavish praise. So, best of luck. You can't start any lower on the football totem pole than Rochdale, but like a bunch of young Irish managers making it in the lower divisions is exactly what we need.
Yeah, exactly. Cork representing on the international stage once again. like it's obviously a theme with Cork hurling managers at the moment in terms of having somebody involved in professional football in the UK, between John Myler and between Jimmy Barry Murphy. So who's next? Who's the next Cork hurling manager? Obviously in between them you had Kieran Kingston. His son, of course, has chosen hurling over soccer, so maybe that might not happen on that front. But yeah, best of luck to him. You kind of think about Jimmy Barry Murphy, the Cork manager, and what has he given to his son? I wonder, is he going to bring any of the Corkonian rebel tactics to Rochdale? We'll wait and see.
Yeah. All right. One of the other big stories that obviously is in all the newspapers today is the fact that John Tracy declined to say yes to having confidence in the FAI board. John Tracy and Kieran Mulvey were before the Joint Oireachtas Committee on Transport, Tourism and Sport yesterday. We had Fergus O'Dowd in studio yesterday, and we did ask him to make sure that the format would be different this time, and it was different, and it yielded much better results, and the format's going to be different next week when the FAI come in. But it turned out the FAI have yet to properly answer the questions that Sport Ireland had sent them with connection to the €100,000 loan that was given to them in 2017 by John Delaney. So obviously we're going to talk about this a little bit later on, but we've got the shot clock coming up next. Last night on the show, Dan McDonald, who I think was at the joint hearing of the Oireachtas Committee, was on talking with Joe on the football show. Have a look.
The specific question was, do you have confidence in the FAI board? It's a yes or no answer.
Well, I'm not saying yes.
Probably, Dan, from what I saw a good bit of it, the most dramatic moment of the Oireachtas Committee this afternoon there.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a small room, Joe. You know, and obviously you're watching it on, you know, people that are watching it on a stream or, you know, TV or whatever way they were watching it. I mean, the size of the room is what you see on the screen, you know, with the exception of maybe two rows at the back for a viewing platform. You know, so there's around, you know, maybe 10, 12, 14 sort of media in there going in and out. So, I mean, when you're close enough to sort of, you know, you could sort of not quite tip someone on the shoulder, but be pretty close. And that sort of silence when he was about to deliver that answer, certainly you could feel it. Mm-hmm. And you know, the significance of what was being said, it was being digested, but really it wasn't massively out of tune, his answer, with what they'd been saying consistently throughout their appearance.
Thinly veiled frustration, I would say, as well, with the fact that the FAI only responded to a second Sport Ireland letter late last night, hand-delivered this morning. And the gist of that letter was, well, we can't really give you any more information about this €100,000 loan until the Mazars audit has taken place. And John Tracy said, there is no legitimate reason why they can't provide us with that information. In fact, they're obligated to.
Yeah, and this review, of course, that was commissioned and announced last week, you know, well after the initial correspondence, say, with Sport Ireland about this issue, well after the story broke initially. So, you know, the FAI now is saying that they're effectively, you know, they're commissioning a review to find out the circumstances behind something which actually, in an initial FAI statement, in response to the Ferrari, they said that the board of the FAI had been informed of all matters.
Yeah.
Now, we're being told that they cannot reply to someone else's queries on this matters until they have an external review. So I think people can digest that in whatever way they choose.
Yeah, that story's going to run and run. So that's your papers. And we're going to start with the shot clock. It's the shot clock. It's with Kieran Donaghy every week. It's fairly simple. We get seven topics. We've got 2 minutes. The air horn sounds at the end of it. And you guys can declare your own winner after that. But I think it's always pretty clear what happens, right? Isn't that the truth, Kieran? Everybody knows what happens?
Well, that's what you say at the start of every show, Joe. So we're just going to go with that for the meantime.
Let's start. Mayo for Sam. Carry for your holidays. Mayo for Sam. That's what we're thinking after the league at the weekend. I think you had Kerry to win by 4 points, and did they lose by four? What happened here, Kieran?
Sure, it's I had Kerry. I fancied Kerry to win. They lost in the league game in bad conditions in Tralee, and I just fancied them to have that kind of hunger and that probably a bit of an edge about them, trying to rewrite that wrong. They were right in the game. It's a funny one. I've watched it twice. We're disappointed to lose. But at the same time, having not played great, we're kind of right in the game late on. So it's a bit of a confusing one for me.
Let me get to your analysis a little bit later on, because I want to specifically talk about the level of celebration that happened afterwards. Kerry famously celebrated the 2017 league final fairly hard. Here's Andy Moran celebrating this, because it's his first league title after 6 million games. Have a look.
If I'm being honest, if you asked me at 8 a.m. this morning, but I'd be saying it's a National League game, it's final, we'd love to win it. But you hear the music afterwards, you see the goal going in, and until you experience that, I don't really think you can imagine how important it is. And if I didn't experience it, I'd have never known it. But I'm very happy now that I've experienced it and seen it. And listen, we need to build now for the summer and try to go for the big one.
Yeah, sometimes these things don't matter, but this one feels a little bit different. It feels like it might matter, Kieran.
It does, and to be honest, for fellas like Andy and Keith Higgins, I'm absolutely delighted for them, because they've put in a lot into that Mayo jersey. And you know, it is about winning things, and the National League is a really big competition now. It's the most competitive out of all the single competitions. Probably you get when you get to the knockout stuff in the summer, semi-finals and finals, it's at its peak then. But the league is where it's at right now, and you know, they've won the league against a lot of very good teams. And they had a shaky patch through the middle of it. So I think I remember people saying like 4 or 5 weeks ago that Mayo, after losing to Galway and they got hammered by the Dubs in Croke Park, that they were gone. Now Mayo are back. So it just shows you from game to game how much it can change. But no, great to see Andy and the boys, and great to see the Mayo fans after the game. People said they might. Did they over-celebrate? Not a hope. Enjoy it. Every win's a big win in Croke Park.
Yeah, you guys know that very well. Here's 2017. You're celebrating. Look. Bottom left corner. This is a Tommy Rooney video special here. Which Dean Rock hits the post, and who's that jumping on the pitch?
Yeah, you'd swear he put a lot into that league. Rocked up for the final, having not trained all year. But exactly. They're there to be won. That was a big one going against Dublin, because they were so dominant at the time. So
if only you got a chance to show them in the summer.
Yeah, you never know. You never know. There's teams lining up now. We'll see who comes.
Next up,
Old Firm taunts. Just watching the game last week and watching Scott Brown at his very best. Just reminded me of some of the games that we used to play against teams that were good at taunting you and good at taking you out of your comfort zone.
Who? But name names. Who's good?
Tyrone.
There you go. We knew it. It's Tyrone.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, there's Joe McMahon. And Joe, I learned a lot off of Joe, actually, because in 2008 he was there. You see him holding his head, nothing wrong with him, but just I'm looking down, kind of going, oh my God, get up off the floor. But yeah, no, it's they do test you, but it's kind of always gone on. Like if I look at what certain teams.
Who's this? Who's that?
Yeah, that's probably me doing a bit of taunting, but that's me reacting to the taunting from Paul Hearty. But it's always gone on the game, Jar. It was more physical back in. If you look at soccer games and football games back in the 70s and 80s, it was physical threats that fellas were saying, yeah, you come in here now and I'm going to break your legs. And that's what was going to happen to you. Whereas now it's gone, you can't really go there.
And then you're all friends again.
Yeah, and that's the learning point I took from it is are you willing to go to the edge of the line to win for your team on the biggest day? Are you going to do that in a physical manner, but are you also going to test your man on a mental level and see is there flaws in him, and see is he going to crack? And you know, you see golfers, you play against golfers, and you see them starting to crack, and you see the pressure starting to mount on them. That's without any talk. So if you can crank up the talk a bit, it's gone on in basketball for years. Trash talk, Jared.
Yeah, totally.
Sledging. They put up loads of names on it. But
what if it goes too far though? What if, like, so you've heard of numbers being written of like family members, girlfriends, wives, whatever? Is that too far?
That is too far. I don't agree with taking it to the air, but I do agree with testing your man to a certain level and just really finding out. Is this fella mentally tough, or is he going to crack? Because if he cracks, and we see golfers cracking, you see their game going all over the place, that can happen to sports people in every court.
You react to Hearty, but you scored a goal past him, so like that's okay. Have there been times when you've reacted to people and you got carried away and you shouldn't have?
Yeah, absolutely. There was two games in 2007 that I got sent off in the league for reacting to both verbal and physical stuff, and I kind of made my mind up after then to play the rest of the career the way I did, which was kind of be in your face and try not to be the guy that's reacting, basically.
You are the one who will be reacted to.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'm the one who knocks.
Test their pulse.
All right, the next one is March Madness. Here's the story, right? We have, for anybody who's unfamiliar with March Madness, it's this month of basketball where the best college teams in the States go for a straight knockout. All of America goes completely mad for it. People do brackets. Very hard to actually win anything in those. And it got this massive coverage and hype and audience. And it's a real sign of if you put stuff together and make knockout things happen, people are interested. It's like a World Cup for college basketball every year, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and the players get nothing.
Yeah, the players get nothing. We've got Michigan State versus Texas Tech, and we've got Virginia versus Auburn. Them games are on at 10 and 12:30 this Saturday. So if you want to watch a real high-level college basketball, tune into those games, because those kids would be literally dying to win the game. They'd fight in their back to win the game. But it's amazing the viewership these kids are getting. A lot of them are 18. The varsities this year are on this week in Ireland, where the college teams go play. And the difference between a college player in America and a college player here, like, you know, these games are getting 20 million, 30 million viewers for an 18-year-old playing at the highest level with his whole family watching. And it's serious pressure on 18 and 19-year-old kids. It's literally amazing what they're doing. You're right, they don't get paid. Some of them will go on to the NBA, some of them will go on to Europe, some of them will go on and never make a bob out of basketball and just go back to a regular 9-to-5. But interesting enough, the players get nothing, but John Calipari, who's the head coach of Kentucky, there was talks of him going to UCLA for $48 million over 5 to 6 years. So,
wow.
Yeah, that's big money, right, Joe?
Wow.
Coach college kids.
And, they never make it to, do they make it to the NBA sometimes? Is that where, does the NBA come looking for?
Yeah, that's all the top players in this March Madness will, you know, a few of them have already declared that they're going to the NBA.
But if you're a coach, is this a pathway to become a coach in the NBA or not?
It's nearly the college job. A lot of them prefer coaching the college kids, because when you're coaching college kids, they're there on scholarship. Tell them be there at 9 o'clock. If they're not there at 9 o'clock, and you see, like, there was Tom Izzo, the great coach from Michigan State, who's also got his team. There he is. He's got his team. He'd have wrote that kid Henry there during March Madness, and there was a big debate about, is that style of coaching gone? He was really aggressive with him. He's in his face coming off. I think there was a bit of showboating at the end of a quarter, at the end of the half, or just before a timeout, and Tom Izzo is right in his player's face, and he sits him down into the huddle of the bench, and he goes at him again, and people are saying, oh, that type of coaching is gone.
Yeah,
I was loving it. You know, yeah, we all want to pat each other on the backs, and we all want to be cool in the dressing rooms, and that's all well and good, but there has to be a small bit of both. You can't just be this mellow Cali guy.
Did you have coaches like that who would...
Yeah, I did. I had guys got in my face. I always reacted well enough to be honest, because I nearly want to prove them wrong if they went at me about something by doing it better, which is probably what they want you to do in essence. But I've had both, and I like both. But I think the coach that has the at the right time that he can spark you.
What'll you be?
I'll be possibly a bit calmer most of the time, but then there will be a time where I will call somebody out if I feel it needs to be done.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah.
In their face, shouting at them?
Yeah, maybe not as bad as Tom Izzo was there with young Henry, but yeah, could get out of hand. Topic four, shaky Liverpool are still winning. So, I've looked at the run-ins, and I wasn't so confident a few months ago, but I think Liverpool might do this now, 6 games to go.
If they do, it's going to be the greatest achievement that we've seen in the Premier League. It'll be as good as anything.
No, it won't be as good as Leicester's.
I don't know.
No, stop!
I don't know. I think it will. I'll tell you why, because Leicester was a fluke. Leicester was a complete fluke. All the other teams were crap that one year.
You can't say a fluke is winning the league in 38 games.
Let me build a case for this.
Okay.
Because this Man City team are winning games routinely, and they're 2-0 up after 40 minutes in every game they're playing at the moment. The game is over before half time. They're just in cruise control. Have they won 21 out of 22 games so far of their last 22 games? It's an unbelievable record. They've got so much money. They've got the best manager that we've seen in world football in 2 decades, and the whole system is built around his style of play and acquiring players that are rising to be brilliant at the moment. Liverpool have come from not great to this point where they're matching them stride for stride in the space of 2.5 years under Jurgen Klopp. If you remember back when Klopp signed, loads of players got injured and there was all this stuff about how Klopp couldn't actually manage a team properly.
Yeah.
And then the style of play emerged and he changed it. He changed from a style of play that reached the Champions League final to be something completely different. And if they manage to topple this Man City team, I think it's going to be one of the greatest achievements that certainly that I've ever seen in football. I just don't think they're going to do it.
Yeah, there's 6 games to go. Man City have Spurs. They haven't been 2 Champions League games, and then they haven't the Sunday afterwards, which could be a bit shaky no matter how they go. Because if they lose that, all the pressure will be on them to beat Spurs again. Spurs will have confidence we've beaten Man City over 2 legs.
That's Liverpool's big chance, really.
I think it is, yeah. And Man United as well is a derby game at Old Trafford that can go anyway. They've also got Leicester who've taken points off all the big teams. Now Liverpool have Chelsea, but they have them at home, so. Yeah, they have to look. It's we were kind of like it with our basketball season this year. We were always behind because we had a game in hand, whereas both teams have played all the games. Now Liverpool are chasing, so they are relying on somebody else to do something for them. So, but I don't know. I know Liverpool fans, and I'll never hear the end of it if you actually win the league. But I'd like to see Liverpool win more than Man City.
The win at the weekend, a last-minute surge or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's big. That's big momentum-wise because that can carry you. They've got Southampton next. Then they got the big Chelsea game. If they can get 6 points out of them, and in that time, the boys live, Man City have played Spurs, so it's...
The ecosystem of a dressing room is very fragile. Stuff like that begins to happen and everybody starts to weirdly believe. It's completely superstitious, but it happens in sport.
It does happen in sport, and they're on a bit of a shaky patch, and they've had 4 wins out of their last 5 games, Liverpool, which is big at this time of the year. So yeah, they're keeping it on the tracks.
Okay, so news this morning from a press conference. 20 years of age, Wexford hurler Rory O'Connor is in the paper saying that by the time he finishes his career, he thinks players will be coming in and getting paid to play GAA. Now, if you think back to a report that was commissioned, one of those other GAA presidents commissioned it, that never saw the light of day, that actually advocated that players would be getting paid by the year 2034, far enough away in the distance so no one actually has to worry about it, but current enough that everybody has to have a conversation about it. Obviously, pay for play, it's never going to happen in the GAA. We all know that. It's an amateur organisation. But is he right? Is there a point in the future, Kieran, where somehow we actually just decide the right thing to do is to pay some players some money?
Look, he's talking about the work that goes into being an inter-county player, and absolutely, it's huge, it's demanding, but if you don't think you can do it or you don't have enough time to do it, there's going to be somebody else in the county that's going to jump in and do it. It is getting far more serious than it was. It's never going to be pay for play. I certainly think the GAA or someone should approach the, you know, tax breaks, I think, are the only way that players can get a break for what they're putting in for their counties and what they're putting in to represent their counties and what they're putting in to bring income into their counties on match days, going to hotels to eat after games. Everything that goes into being a county player has a knock-on effect on the community, and if your county is a good run in the competition, your club is a good run, there's a big knock-on effect there. But I think you can only get to the stage where if you've played for your county for 15 years, you get a certain tax break. If you play for your county for 10 years, you get a certain tax break. If you play for 5 years, you get a certain tax break. You're not coming in for a year. And
yeah, let me just play devil's advocate for a second.
Yeah,
what about the volunteer who's volunteered for 40 years and has never got a tax break? Like, how do you place the value?
I think the volunteer depends on the volunteer has they're unbelievable in the GAA community. We wouldn't function without the volunteers in every club. But what inter-county players are putting off on their actual lives to represent their counties now is a huge demand. Whether it's college, whether it's staying in college for another few years so we can be professional footballers, because that's what a lot of kids are doing now, and that's wrong, because you need to get out into the workforce, you need to find out what you're about, you need to go earn money, you need to go buy a house, set your life up for your family and stuff.
What about the other thing that's happening, the drain on the best young players to the AFL, because the lure of professional sport is so great. So Mark O'Connor of Kerry heads off to the AFL to play. Apparently he's making a huge impression in the last few weeks, and apparently he's Kerry's best midfielder at the moment, according to Owen Sheehan. So like, that's just going to continue to happen, right? It's going to happen more and more.
It's going, and that's the lure of it. It's like the kid that's very good at soccer and very good at football, and next thing they get a call at 16 to go over to Southampton or somewhere. They're going to, you know, it's a no-brainer. But like, I don't even think that the tax break is going to keep fellas in Ireland. I just think it's a reward for everything that they're doing that actually makes their life harder when you retire. We're going to have a lot of fellas retiring there at 30 that might have 2 years of work behind them because they've been in college so long, or because they went and took breaks or whatever, or couldn't. Like, it's very hard for a guy to actually go in now at 8 o'clock, work to 6 every day. That's hard for an inter-county player to do. Where do you do your gym? How many, where are you getting the right diet into you? There's so much that goes on. So I think tax breaks. Just give us tax breaks, Ger.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that.
Ah, stop.
You're on an island there for now. Anyway, did the attacking mark work? This is what we want to ask about the league. So obviously the rules come in just for the league. We revert back to the old rules for the championship now because that's how things work, and maybe they'll be introduced after Congress next year into the championship. Does the attacking mark work? Do we want the game to be more like Aussie rules? What the hell? What do you think, Kieran?
Yeah, do we want the game to be more like Aussie rules? What we want is trying to figure out the game to be more enjoyable for the viewer, more enjoyable for the person that goes to the game, that buys that ticket, that takes his family in on a Sunday for a 3-hour drive up to watch a game. What we want to see is that buzz, and we get it in hurling all the time. The high ball is going in, it's 50-50. There's guys competing for it, there's guys scrapping for it. It brings great excitement to games. And I think what the mark brought to the GAA and the league was it brought a bit of excitement again. That big ball was going into the square a bit more often by most of the teams would try it. And you know, it was something that was working, and some teams were getting joy off it, and fellas were catching the ball, and now you were able to play on and try and get a goal, which is always the answer. If you catch a ball in around the house, is to play on and try and get a goal. But if you land in the 3 or 4 around you, you take your mark and you take your pint, and it encourages guys to kick in the ball a bit more, which encourages guys to take risks, which is what football has gone away from slightly, which is what I didn't like about it. It was a turnover, was kicking it into the full forward or the corner forward or whoever, the big guy inside or a small guy, kicking it in high, turning it over, and it's a turnover, and it goes down in your stat sheet, Kieran, the 3 turnovers again. Yeah, I took 3 risks, I was trying to put in 3 good balls to Tommy Welsh. Yeah. Like, are they turnovers? Oh, sorry. Do you know what I mean? Like, we're
is that a real conversation that happened?
I would be saying that I fought long and hard to have it in, that if someone put in a diagonal ball, that it was not counted as a turnover, right? Just put it in and we'll talk about it afterwards. Let me try and worry about winning it. But it is a conversation that happened because I felt fellas were getting a bit cautious with the ball because turnovers and stats, and how many stats do you have, how many times do you have possession, how many turnovers do you have, how many kick passes, how many hand passes. You know, if you have 25 possessions and 23 hand passes, what are you really doing in the game? Like,
yeah,
you know,
who cares?
Yeah, who you unlock and what defence you unlock. Like the ball Aidan O'Shea put in the last day.
Yeah, like what a sensational ball.
Yeah, he could have got it and hand passed it off. But he saw a goal, he saw a chance, and he delivers a pinger on the outside of his left and it goes in around the house and it's perfect, and they should get a goal off it. So it's, I think the mark has been brilliant. And just because it's an Aussie rules rule, you know, we talked about it in Shot Clock episode 1, the 50 metre rule, if anybody's still listening out there, please bring it in so we can get rid of these fucking black cards and yellow cards.
I think it's a great idea. I mean, we should continue that lobbying campaign that we have. Let's move on and talk about Aidan O'Shea's performance, because we want to ask that the big question is who can actually dethrone Dublin. We've got 5 minutes on this. It's our proper analysis of the league campaigns of the two teams. And I think that, you know, Aidan O'Shea's performance, and I think the return of James Horan has made... It all makes sense. Everything that has happened over the last number of years now seems to me to make sense, that Horan went away, took a little bit of time out, thought about deeply about what was happening in the game, thought about what he'd done wrong the last time, comes back. There's just a right blend of those young players coming through, expressing their leadership. And it would be a massive outpouring of emotion for 30 counties. Yeah. If Mayo were to win, it would give a lot of teams a bit of hope. And I think they're right there. I think they're just nipping at Dublin's heels at the minute.
Yeah, they are. And they were, you know, when you look at last week, when the game was there to be won, I think really it was just Mayo who grabbed it that bit more. And, you know, probably that bit more desperate for the win. And, it, we watch it so much top-level sport. It often boils down to that. It was just... We can talk to tactics and they do matter, and you can talk about instances in games, but it's the one percenters, it's the hunger levels around the pitch, it's the getting back, it's getting a hand in, it's taking a goal when some people say you should hand pass it over the bar. It's them little inches that make the difference. And I think Mayo have definitely, you're right, under James Horan, just found a bit of rejuvenation. That win against Kerry was their statement. They'd lost 2 and they came down to Tralee, down to Kerry, who hadn't lost, and they said, we're winning this game. And that's what it looked like 5 minutes in. I was doing commentary for Air Sport 5 minutes in, and I looked at Willie Joe Pedden and I said, Kerry are in trouble. I just knew by the way they were going about it.
I think it's interesting too, listening to the clip that we played a little bit earlier on, when a team, it wasn't that they didn't want to win, it was like, oh, I'm not sure about this. Andy Moore was talking about, you know, 8 o'clock this morning, if he'd said to me, I would have said, no, it doesn't actually matter. But then when you do win, there's a difference. It's like a dam burst.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I'm most interested in seeing, what the impact of that is from Mayo's perspective, is that, like, so they've always been a mean team. You know, you could see them going up against Dublin and never taking a backward step.
Yeah.
And almost no other team, maybe your team, but almost no other team has been the same. Even Tyrone, who traditionally would have been able to match Dublin, always took a backward step against Dublin as soon as Dublin smacked them in the mouth. That Mayo team never did. But there was just a little bit of something. There was something in the back of their head that was saying they're not going to get over the line. You get over the line in a big game like this, coming from behind the way they did, I think that has a knock-on impact and propels them into the summer as like a very, very dangerous side.
Yeah, it probably propels them into kind of number two spot behind Dublin, really. I'd kind of Kerry there. I still think Kerry, like, you know, if they get things right, you know, I think possibly they might have to look at getting Sean O'Shea out to the middle of the field to play alongside Jack Barry. I think Dermot O'Connor was very good there the last day, but I think himself and Jack are very similar type players. They're both extremely talented athletes. They both work hard and they both got great running ability, great carrying ability, but they're both similar. And I always found it in field, it's always good to have a kind of a fella that's solid defensively that can carry, but then it's always good to have a footballer. And we've been very lucky to have Dave Moran for the last kind of nearly 10 years as a midfielder for Kerry, you know, being a ball player, being able to give him the ball. And, you know, Dave's coming back and that's going to be a huge thing for Kerry in the summer. But I think Kerry have so many forwards. I think you can get a guy like Sean O'Shea and say, Sean, go out to eight there and get on as much. He can do the same from midfield that he does from centre forward. He can come on late and score points. He can take all the frees. He can use his athleticism. He can use his ball playing ability. And maybe not be tagged as hard as he was at centre back the last day when they basically put Lee Keegan on him and said, Wrap this kid up, just do what you did to Dermot Connolly a few times and make his life a misery. And
is that an option, do you think?
I played my first ever game against Sean O'Shea, and my first time ever coming across him, I knew of him, was playing midfield against him in a county championship quarter final, and he gave me a run around. No, I was probably 34 at the time, but he was brilliant. Like, you know, he was tough, he was hard, he was good. Nice. He was good in the air. But again, it was his football that I found the hardest thing, because every time he got on the ball, he was taking me on, he was playing 1-2s, he was power running off me. So it was it hasn't been looked at, and he probably played so well at centre forward for UCC and Kerry so far this year that people would be like, no way.
Yeah.
But just think about it, like, Kerry have an amount of forwards. We're struggling for a ball player in midfield. We've tried Mark Griffin, who's been very good again, but solid, and a defensive presence, bursting forward, making runs. But again, you know, there's no comparison in football ability between Sean O'Shea and any of the three of the other lads. And I think we just need a bit more footballing ability out around midfield. And, you know, it'd free him up. Like, it's much harder for a midfielder. Midfielders aren't tracked, really, to think like a centre-back or a corner-back where they're constantly watching you as a man.
Yeah, so you
they
can
switch off you. Yeah, they yeah. switch off you, look over their shoulder, go help somebody, and then Sean is coming off your back. But I think something like that. Kerry were, I was happy enough with Kerry last day, but there was stages where we were making mistakes where, I don't know, was it tiredness? Was it that the running ability of Mayo eventually wears you down? But we made mistakes in the second half that were criminal, like, you know, turnovers.
I think, though, that we were talking a little bit about this earlier on, that Kerry are a team, because of their age profile, who will not be the same team come July and August, that actually their ability to grow as the ground quickens in horse racing, like, they're going to grow into themselves because they're such a young team.
Yep.
And actually being a young team is a real advantage at this stage of the year, where you've come so far that your growth can be exponential. Whereas I'd say with Mayo, we have a fair idea that Mayo are going to improve consistently over the course of the summer, but we know exactly what they're going to be. With Kerry, they've no ceiling. They could be anywhere, and they could be anything.
They could, and, you know, I think the result the weekend was good for both sides. It'll put Kerry, you know, that 5 wins in a row, and, you know, and then, you know, everything is going so smooth. It'll curb a bit of that, which is good for Kerry. we like being kind of,
yeah,
we like coming out of the long grass.
And there was no long grass if they'd won that game.
Yeah, well, if they'd have beaten Mayo and Tralee and beaten Mayo and Croke Park, they'd have won eight in a row, and everyone would be saying, "Oh my God, Kerry, you're flying." So they're right there. They're right there. I think one or two tweaks, and yeah, I think it's going to be exciting. Them two teams are certainly knocking on the door.
Realistically, there's four teams, maybe five, who consider themselves challengers to the Dubs. You've got Mayo and Kerry, who we've spoken about. Tyrone will obviously feel pretty good about life. And Galway and Monaghan. Monaghan beat them in the league. Are they sneaking into, if we were to rank top five contenders?
Yeah, I think Monaghan and their day are definitely in the top five. I just don't know, did I see enough out of them after that first Dublin game in the league this year to merit that? But, you know, you look at Donegal coming through again with Michael Murphy back fit. He's a big presence for them. They're going to be there or thereabouts. They're going to be in the Super 8s again. So I'd maybe sneak them into my top five, but certainly Galway Tyrone is a hard one to pick who's ahead of who, because Tyrone, probably being in the All-Ireland final last year, would merit it. But I just think if Galway get it right with their defensive shape that they have, but if they can go away now for 6 or 7 weeks and kind of figure out, okay, get these few Corrifin lads inside, what do you do? What's your movement? Can we learn a bit? Can put the egos away? If I them Corrifin lads, I'd be coming in. And what are you doing? If I was the manager of God, what are you doing in training? What do you like to do?
Three-man weaves, though, right?
We've talked about the three-man weaves, but I think they're doing a bit more than three-man weaves. But I think actually they just have a bunch of smart players, Corrifin, and I think the more of them you can get into your forward lineup, the better. So, and you've Damien Cormier coming back.
So let's rank them. Mayo number one
to challenge Dublin.
Yeah.
Mayo.
Oh,
Kerry.
You want to say Kerry? Okay, so Kerry number one.
We'll give Mayo number one.
All right. Okay. So it goes Mayo number one, Kerry number two.
Yeah. I think Galway, if they can get Comer and the Corrifin lads in, and Tyrone. That's very tight between Tyrone and Galway, but I think they are the top four or five teams in the country with Dublin. And then you've got your Monaghans, your Donegals after that.
Okay, so Tyrone are ahead of Donegal just a little bit.
Yeah, oh yeah.
All right, good stuff. That was... Sure, we'll see, I suppose.
Sure, we'll see, I suppose.
But I don't feel this the same way about Dublin this year as I have done in previous years, where they are unstoppable, where you kind of know, look, this is all just a charade this year. It doesn't feel that way. It feels like they're going to get games, that there will be doubts, that we haven't seen Dublin perform at a level that we know they're capable of since... last year, and even last year, they were kind of grand.
Yeah, they're like Dublin always have the answers, and it's until somebody can prove that they don't have enough answers in a day, that's when we're going to find out when this team are beaten. But up to now, in the last 4 years, whatever way you throw it at them, whether you do what we did in 16 and you win 5 points up and you're get all the momentum, they figure it out, they come back and beat you. Whether they concede 2 own goals against Mayo, they'll come back and beat you. So somebody's going to have to test them properly and test their pulse and have the physical ability to play with them, but also have the bit of magic, have the bit of Picardia that somebody's going to up front is going to just have one of those games where an Andy Moran gets 2-4 or David Clifford gets 2-5. It's going to need someone to grab it by the scruff of the neck, and that's down the road, and that's what it's going to take a team to do.
Yeah, and it's something to look forward to properly. Shot clock is over. Kieran, good stuff. Thanks very much.
Thanks a million, Joe.
Right, we've been looking back at our back row power rankings all this week. Here's who Liam Toland reckons is Ireland's number one open side. Have a look.
For me, if you'd all the open sides available to Ireland, the best open side in Ireland is still Sean O'Brien, in the sense that he can do it all. He can carry, his breakdown. About 5 years ago, he changed his breakdown routine. Maybe it was a result of being part of the Lions tours and that sort of stuff and learning from that. But he definitely became much more technically proficient around the breakdown, but he was doing all the other stuff as well. So my worry for him would be that how much damage has been done to his hips, his back, all the kind of the muscular skeletal system of him. Will he ever get back to the level that we know, his world-class level? And only time will tell that. But I'd have concerns about, is he able to get back to that level? Will his body allow him to get back to that level? And that's the big conundrum for him. When you shift off him, then his absence through injury has given us a sight of Dan Levy, Josh van der Fleer, and other options as well, which shows that they're different players to him. But Dan Levy in particular, I don't know their top end speed I'd say O'Brien looks faster than him, but the work he does around the breakdown is almost Pocock stuff. It's Hooper stuff. It's really, really, really important. It's a totally different style. So the solution for Ireland and Leinster is going to be interesting. But we saw Reece Ruddock playing at seven for Ireland against South Africa. So the balance then becomes, like Conan showed last Saturday, why I think he's such a brilliant ball carrier. He creates space. If you had him at eight, you could conceivably have a Peter O'Mahony and a CJ Stander in the back row as well. You can dilute that with a variety of, and Geordie Murphy comes into the equation hugely, and Jack O'Donoghue and Tommy O'Donnell. Jack O'Donoghue came on, who started in Thomond Park there a couple of weeks ago. I thought he was brilliant for the opening 40 minutes. So there is strength and depth, but no one quite like Sean O'Brien.
Yeah, that's unfortunately the truth. Neil Tracy is here with us. Neil, how are you?
Good morning, Ger. How are you?
Sean O'Brien, our number one back row.
Yeah, probably at the moment. It is. It's probably a bit cruel to say, but like, you know, an injury like that for Dan Levy, it does open the door. You know, the opportunity is there for others, and you know, Van der Fleer and Levy probably would have got that opportunity last year when Sean O'Brien was that injured. So it, you know, it goes around both ways. Also, there is what, you know, Reece, you know, Liam mentioned them all: Reece Ruddock, Geordie Murphy, Josh Van der Fleer when he gets back fit. Even Jack O'Donoghue is kind of coming in around the outside. He's getting back to his fitness. We might see him get a few more games towards the business end of the year. But there's a spot there and there are a lot of contenders. I think Sean O'Brien at the moment just about has it.
Yeah, it's interesting that we were all kind of like, oh, the World Cup squad is so deep now that there's no chance for anybody to be a bolter. And now here we are a few months out going, well, actually, there could be a few bolters.
Mm-hmm.
So
maybe let's... Picking a World Cup team, World Cup squad in January sometimes doesn't work out. Who would have thunk it?
Just exactly, yeah.
We should pick a team just of bolters. Where are we starting?
Manchester City, obviously. Their game of cat and mouse with Liverpool at the top of the Premier League table continued last night. They retook top spot with a comfortable 2-0 win against relegation-threatened Cardiff. They barely broke sweat to earn the 3 points. First-half goals for Kevin De Bruyne and Leroy Sané made it a very comfortable night at the office. It's the third time the Premier League lead has swapped hands in the last 5 days. It can be 4 in 6 days tomorrow if Liverpool win away to Southampton. Cardiff, meanwhile, are 5 points from safety with 6 games to play after last night's match. City boss Pep Guardiola said it was a job professionally done.
We have the feeling if we draw points, we will not be champion. You know, midweek, Cardiff, all the people say will be easy. The way we start, the commitment in all details, in the corners, in the throw-ins, in be focused on what we have to do, it was really good.
Spurs marked their first game at the new Tottenham Hotspur Stadium with a win. After a 7-month delay in construction, they finally got to show off their new home, running out 2-0 winners against Crystal Palace with second-half strikes from Heung-min Son and Christian Eriksen, seeing them get back up to third place in the table. Mauricio Pochettino said he was delighted with how his team handled the occasion.
A special moment, a special night. I think not too many people have the possibility to be on the open day in the, I believe, and I feel that this is the best stadium in the world. And of course, maybe the goals wasn't the best goal, but important to win, feel the victory again. The 3 points for us, and I think that was the objective.
Goal difference is all that keeps Chelsea outside the Champions League places after a 3-0 win against Brighton at Stamford Bridge. A superb effort from Ruben Loftus-Cheek was the standout in a comfortable win. In Scotland, Celtic remained 13 points clear at the top of the Premiership. They had a 2-0 win against St Mirren last night. But the match was overshadowed by a missile thrown from Celtic fans in the direction of the opposition goalkeeper. Speaking after the match, Celtic manager Neil Lennon had a clear message to those involved.
The health and safety of the players on the pitch is paramount. The St Mirren goalkeeper and some of our players got a huge threat from that. Like I said, I don't think from the club's point of view that we just don't want them in the ground. And all it did was not only could it hurt somebody, but it puts a delay in the game that we don't really need.
In rugby, Conor Murray says he's confident that he's returning to form. The Munster and Ireland scrum half has endured a frustrating season with a neck injury ruling him out of the first 3 months of the campaign. He admits he was frustrated with his performances for Ireland in the Six Nations, but he has helped Munster overcome Edinburgh in the Heineken Champions Cup quarterfinals at the weekend. He also insists that the neck injury that kept him out for the first few months of the season is no longer an issue.
Look, I'm great. I feel like injury-wise, I feel. I heard someone say that, you know, your neck mustn't be right. And like, I wish I could blame my neck for the Six Nations, but that is absolutely A1. Thankfully, feel really strong that way. Particularly at the weekend, you know, we defended an awful lot. I ended up making quite a few tackles and tested it out again and again. Like, I had full confidence in it before, but came through that pretty well.
Robbie Henshaw hopes to be back in action for Leinster's Heineken Champions Cup semi-final against Toulouse. He's been missing since picking up a dead leg in the Six Nations defeat to England in February. He has resumed running in training, but this week's Pro 14 game against Benetton has come too soon. His last outing was for Ireland at full back in the opening Six Nations defeat to England two and a bit months ago. And he was asked if he'd fancy a return to the number 15 jersey for Leinster.
Listen, I started my career at full back for Connacht. Played loads there. Was happy to play there against England. You know, it's a different kettle of fish at international level, and I know that. But you know, I'd be happy to play there again. But at the moment, it's probably back to the centre in Leinster and focus on my rugby there and finishing the season strong.
Mad details in the papers today about the nature of the interview. Saw a specialist in England. The specialist said it's one of the rarest forms of dead legs he's ever seen. Four in his entire life.
He's seen four of those.
Yeah.
Wow.
Blood vessel.
Leaking,
says? Yeah, in his upper leg. Just the connection.
And it
was.
Just gave off all the basic symptoms of a normal dead leg initially.
I presume to Robbie Henshaw it did, yeah. And he was wondering why is this thing taking so long. Because I presume when you get injured in the lead-up to a game like you did before the Scotland game, there was a chance, probably in the Ireland medical team, that this guy could play this weekend. Mm-hmm. And now here we are, weeks and weeks later. So I presume it was instantly appreciated by the medical staff in the IRFU that this thing was a little bit different, and the specialist was like, yeah, I've only seen three or four of these things in my entire career.
Incredible. Elsewhere, Munster and Ulster will both name their teams this lunchtime for tomorrow night's Pro 14 games. Munster host Cardiff in Cork, while Ulster travel to the Glasgow Warriors. In racing, there are four Grade 1s on the opening day of the Grand National Meeting at Aintree. Le Baga Raw is set to go off favourite in the opener. The Devonish Manifesto Novices chase at 1:45. The feature on day one is the Aintree Hurdle at 3:25. Beaufort Air is an odds-on favourite to bounce back from a third-place finish in the Champion Hurdle at Cheltenham last month. And finally, Graham McDowell's bidding to secure a last-minute place at the Masters this week. The final spot at the first major of the year will go to this week's winner of the Valero Texas Open. Padraig Harrington and Seamus Power are also part of the field in San Antonio.
All right, good stuff, Neil. Thanks very much for that. We will be getting John Duggan in studio a little bit later on to give you some Aintree tips. And we're also going to hear from the GPA co-founder Donal O'Neill in studio talking about his new documentary, which is about cardiac screening. We'll get to all that in a couple of minutes' time. First, though, Ireland and Southampton teenage striking sensation Michael Obafemi bounced into the offices yesterday afternoon for a chat with Owen. Here's how it went. Have a look.
All right, exciting times for anybody around Dublin because the Premier League trophy is going to be in Dundrum with thanks to Coca-Cola on the 13th of April between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. So if you're around that part of town, make sure to get down there, because not only with thanks to Coca-Cola will the Premier League trophy be there, but Michael Obafemi is going to be there as well, and he's with me in studio right now. Michael, you're very welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
How are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
When I say that, it's like the last time we saw your name in the headlines was the injury, your hamstring. You're just telling us there that you haven't had to undergo surgery, so it's good news, I presume.
Yeah, I mean, I was obviously ecstatic when I found out I didn't have to have surgery. But now I'm on the mend, and I've not got too long left, and I'm just working hard to get back fit. So yeah,
it's been a couple of injuries at this point now. Have you got the hang of dealing with all that free time?
I think the first one I struggled with because obviously I was in the first team, and obviously I wanted to play, but obviously that set me back, and I struggled a bit. But now I think this one I've come to terms with it. And I've learnt how to manage it off the pitch as well. Doing stuff like watching other players, other strikers, and like learning how to adapt my game when I come back and get back training. So yeah.
Who are you watching?
I've been watching Suarez. He's very smart.
He is
very smart. I've been watching Aguero and Lacazette and Aubameyang. Really.
Right. That's. I want the similarities in their play. Their movement, I'd imagine, is very interesting to watch.
Yeah, I say Suarez's movement is probably the best out of all of them. But I'd say they all have obviously good movement, and especially Aguero, good finishing as well. So, yeah.
What is it about Suarez's movement that sets him apart from the rest?
I think he just thinks like two steps ahead of the defender. He's always a step ahead of the defender. So, yeah.
So, Luis Suarez, what specifically then are you actually looking at in terms of what you can take from it?
I'd say I'm just looking at how I can put that into my game, how I can be one step, two step ahead of the defender instead of just reacting in the moment, because then I'd create more chances for myself, and obviously which could help us win the game. So, yeah, that's ultimately what I'm looking for.
Has your football so far to date in your career all been based on instinct?
I wouldn't say so, but I'd say it's in the first team, like in obviously top levels, different to when you're playing under-23s, under-18s football. I'd say more instinct than not.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I'm adapting and I'm changing my game as each day comes, yeah.
I guess the greatness is always achieved when you have that level of instinct, when you have that natural talent and you have a great coach or a great ability to understand tape to improve that.
Yeah, I'd say so as well. Especially with our new coach coming in as well, who's very focused on pressing and winning the ball back fast and keeping the ball and counter-attacking. I think with a good coach as well, anything can happen. Like, he can push like young players, which is obviously what our coach is doing, and giving everyone chances, so yeah.
Yeah, and like when it comes to, say, the people you've been watching all your life, is this obviously a new fascination with the likes of Luis Suarez, or has he always been your hero in that respect?
I would say he's always been my hero. I say Omri has been a big impact, because I watched him, obviously, when I was younger, and what he did for Arsenal was amazing, and hopefully I can replicate that, but obviously for Southampton. Yeah, but I think what he done was amazing, so yeah.
You mentioned three Arsenal strikers there. Are you an Arsenal fan? I'm an Arsenal fan, it's okay. Yeah.
I would say, apart from Southampton, Arsenal would be my team, yeah.
It'd be your second team.
Yeah.
You talk about your struggles there to start after your first injury, which was against Manchester United. Yeah. You were saying it must be a bittersweet moment, you know, getting the chance to play against Manchester United and then having to hobble off with an injury as well. What were those struggles like? Was it kind of trying to find out how to actually recover from it? Was it a frustration, or what was the emotion?
Well, obviously, it was my first start in the Premier League, I got my first assist as well. And in like the 60th minute, I just felt it, and then I just felt distraught, and then for like, and I was just, obviously I found out like it was this like six to eight week injury or however long it was. I just found it hard, like the whole process, like the rehab and everything, because like I didn't really want to, obviously I didn't want to be injured, like no one wants to be injured, but like I just didn't really know how to come to terms with it. But the staff and everyone helped me, and eventually I come back fit, and I was raring to go.
Mm.
And that's when I came back against Huddersfield, where I got my first goal, and then the next day did it again, which that was a very low point, because obviously I just scored my first Premier League goal. Youngest for Southampton to do so as well in the Premier League. But I'd say, yeah, I struggled then the most. I struggled like quite a bit. But I'm thankful for the staff, because they helped me a lot. They just stuck by me and just helped me get back fit, yeah.
Because ultimately, your entire life, it's not only the thing that you love to do, it's your livelihood, it's a career that every moment counts, really, and it's been kind of ripped away from you repeatedly.
Yeah, I'd say, yeah, I've had a lot of bittersweet moments. Obviously, my first start injury, first goal injury, and obviously I came back against Arsenal as well, and it happened again. So, but yeah, I just got to keep my head up high and then keep going, so yeah.
And have you been doing anything differently during this time out to ensure that it doesn't happen again?
I'd say we're being more taking our time more. I wouldn't say we pushed me back too fast in the first place anyway, but we're just taking our time more in this one and making sure we get everything right, make sure it's as strong as possible so that it don't happen again in the future. So yeah.
I'd imagine I'd just be bored out of my tree during that time. Like, I mean, there's only so many Suarez videos you can watch. Yeah. Like, do you do anything else? Do you play video games or what it is to pass the time?
Yeah, I like to play a bit of Xbox, PS4. But,
what do you play?
NBA. I stopped playing Fortnite. Nah, stopped playing.
Too addictive.
Yeah, stopped playing that. I play a bit of Division 2 now.
Right.
FIFA as well, but not as much as before. I don't really think they did very good this year.
Yeah, that's what we've been told. David Myler was saying that it's not as good as FIFA 18.
Nah, it's not. FIFA 18 was a good game, but I don't think they've done that well with it this year. But I'd say the game I play most is NBA.
Right. Any particular team?
Who's my team? Well, to be honest, I support LeBron James.
Right, wherever he goes.
Wherever he goes, I support. So right now, Lakers. And obviously, they didn't make the playoffs, so it's a bit...
Pretty disappointing for them.
Yeah, very disappointing.
It's interesting, your manager was talking about video game addiction there recently, wasn't he? It's I could certainly speak about video game addiction. I think I played Football Manager 2012 up until the year of, like, 2020, or probably 2220, really, I should say. I think you had retired, actually, in that game by the time I started playing. It's a real thing, really. It's a danger as well when you got a bit of idle time.
Yeah. I mean, you just got to learn how to manage yourself, really. Obviously, like, have, like, an hour or two on it, and just, like, go have a break, watch TV or socialise or something, you know?
Yeah.
Instead of just staying on it for, like, hours and upon hours, you know? But, yeah.
Or go watch some more Suarez videos or something like that.
Exactly.
It's good to hear you're on the mend, though, and it's good to see you're in a positive mindset about all of that. But it's the first time we've had you in studio. I mean, we haven't got a chance to actually speak to you. So you were born in Dublin to Nigerian parents.
Yep. My mum came over to see her sisters, and that's when Michael and Femi was born.
Right, okay, so she had sisters living in Ireland already, she came just for a holiday?
Yeah, she just came to visit them because she hadn't seen them in like quite a while, so she came over, saw them, and then I popped out.
The rest is history, the year 2000.
Exactly, yeah, millennium baby. You know what I mean?
And how long did you hang around Dublin for?
I actually do not know.
Right.
I do not know the answer, but... all I remember is growing up in London. That's all I remember, really. But yeah.
In Essex?
Yeah. Well, no, I grew up in East London.
Right.
In an area called Chingford.
Oh, yes.
But and then I moved to Essex in around 2011 or so. Yeah, started secondary school. That's when I moved to Essex.
It's interesting looking back. I wonder, like, moving over to London and comparing it to what the opportunities are in Ireland, you must be thankful that you had the opportunity to be in London with all these great academies going around. And I guess the irony of that is that you actually started off playing Sunday League football.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you got to start somewhere.
Mm.
I started at a local team, Ryan FC, and then I got scouted for Watford. I remember, yeah, Watford. And... I signed there. I signed at Watford. My brother was also there. And then... But he didn't get his scholarship there. And then I got released at the same time as well. And then he went to Leighton Orient. And then I quit football for a year. Because I don't know. Like, after I got released, I don't know, I just fell out of love. You know, and I just felt a bit down. And I eventually went to Leighton Orient with my brother. And he was in the first team there. I was in, like, under 14s, 15s there. And then that's when Southampton came along.
Right, OK. What did Watford say at the time when they released you?
They actually didn't say anything to me personally. They said it to, like, my parents on the phone. So I was like, oh, OK.
And they just didn't see a potential there? Or they clearly got it wrong?
Yeah, well, I mean... Clearly. But I don't remember much about it, but I just remember my parents telling me that I'd been released, and that's about it, really.
Yeah, it's amazing the way yourself and your brother were so closely aligned at that point as well. Was it always a situation where there was some sort of friendly rivalry in the family?
No, I wouldn't say so, because he was always like older and bigger than me.
Mm.
So, like... Where I was in, like, under 14s, 15s, he was always, like, with the men's and stuff. So I wouldn't say there was a rivalry there, but I would always, like, aspire to be like him, you know? Because, obviously, when you're that young, you look up to your older brothers and older siblings. So, yeah, I was just trying to be like him in a way, so, yeah.
How did you find the academy structures as opposed to, say, Ryan FC? Because with Ryan FC, I'd imagine you can bang in the goals every single week and you get confidence, and maybe you actually build up a better skill set as a result of that as opposed to being in an academy as a kid.
Yeah, I'd say I enjoyed my time at Ryan FC. I remember everything about Ryan FC, to be fair, all the tournaments and everything. But I remember as well when I was at Watford, I remember one game, I scored 11 goals.
For Watford?
Yeah.
And they released you?
Yeah, I mean, not much I could do, not much more I could do, but I... yeah, I scored 11 goals. I remember that.
I'm not a football. I'm not going to say I'm a football director expert or an expert in scouting. But if I see a kid who scores 11 goals in a game, I'm probably not going to release him.
Yeah, I mean, I was a bit mischievous as well, but I don't think that had a part in it. But yeah,
what sort of mischief are we talking?
No, I mean, just silly stuff, really. You know, classroom joker. You know, not everyone can tolerate that, but you know.
Your most important talking is done on the pitch, I suspect. You said you sprinted as well as a kid. You did a lot of athletics.
Yeah, I did like 100 meters, sometimes 200 for my school and stuff, but mainly 100. Yeah,
it's interesting because we've been speaking about this quite a bit on the show over the past couple of months about the connection between athletics and other sports. And Dervla O'Rourke said that basically she looks at rugby players and how some of them aren't actually running correctly.
Yeah.
Like, I wonder if your athletics training has actually helped you get that extra yard of pace, or your technique is just that little bit better, and that ultimately the cross-pollination of both things has been a huge positive for you.
Yeah, I think having a good technique in running could actually help you run faster, because obviously it does in athletics. So I think obviously it can help you in football as well, give me the extra yard that I can on the defenders and get behind, so, which is a big part of my game. So yeah, I'd say so, yeah.
So you move on to Southampton eventually when all this happens. Why did you pick Southampton? Like, they've obviously got a great record when it comes to producing young talent.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you can see the record: Gareth Bale, Theo Walcott, Chamberlain, Luke Shaw, you know, Lallana, Mane, well, not Mane, but, you know, all of them that's come through Southampton. And, I mean, hopefully I can be the next one, you know, just get games week in, week out, play well, you know, and show everyone what I can do, you know.
Is there a particular reason why they're so good at producing young talent?
I'd say, because, the club in itself, everyone's just together. No one thinks they're bigger than whoever, anyone. Everyone just speaks to everyone. There's no real outsiders or any big time players, you know. So everyone just speaks to everyone. So yeah,
no egos in the dressing room, which is a really important thing.
Yeah, I think everyone, you know, gets along with everyone, and team nights out and stuff, and bonding and stuff, it's also good. So yeah.
And what has the new manager brought in? Well, he's not that new anymore, I guess, in Ralf Hasenhüttl. Like, is it a much more positive atmosphere in the dressing room than when Mark Hughes was in there?
I'd say we're obviously in a better place now than we was under last manager. But, yeah, I think, everyone's just confident. Everyone's, expressing themselves. Obviously, we're climbing the table now, moving away from the... relegation zone, but yeah, I think he's done well.
Yeah, he absolutely has, and it's great to see you climbing the table. We must finish up on Ireland, obviously. There's been a change of manager with Southampton, there's been a change of manager with Ireland, obviously. Martin O'Neill gave you your first cap, so I'd imagine you've got pretty fond memories of his era, and Mick McCarthy, we've got to wait to see you in a green shirt under him yet.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully I come back from injury and there's games coming up in June. And hopefully I'm fit and healthy to play in them, but it's just whether I get picked, I guess, or whether it's worth me even going, you know. But yeah, I mean, I definitely want to get back in a green shirt, you know, represent my country.
Was there ever any decision to be made about not representing Ireland?
No,
it was always Ireland.
I don't know, the media, obviously, you know, they big up everything. No, bring England, Nigeria into it. But no, I don't think them two was even on the cards, really. But yeah.
Because I think our pride has been wounded a small bit after different events over the last couple of months, that people are like, if there's a chance to pick England or Nigeria over Ireland, there's a better chance of making the World Cup there. So I think we were all delighted to have you, but there was never any question, obviously, on your sense of things. But it's been great to chat to you, Michael. You're very welcome into the studio. So he's going to be back in Dublin, as I say, on April the 13th, as Coca-Cola are bringing the Premier League trophy to Dundrum Town Centre. There's going to be competitions and prizes to be won, including the chance to win VIP tickets to Premier League games. You'll also get the chance to meet this man, Michael Obafemi. Thank you so much.
You do indeed. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, Michael Obafemi winning the heart of Owen Sheehan, two young London boys doing well.
he's a young Irish boy, as am I. And it's good to finally have. Well, actually, there's a positive and a negative. It's positive to have a sports person in that's actually a little bit shorter than me, but a negative having a sports person in that actually makes me feel old.
But also that you have to bring it up, you know. It's like you couldn't just have left it unsaid there.
Absolutely not. This is like the one and only opportunity I'll ever get.
He's definitely a winning personality.
If that's how he's talking at 18 years of age. Give him a couple of years of actually understanding the media game a little bit. Hopefully he doesn't understand it too much get media trained too much, because he's got a really bubbly personality, really nice guy, very personable, and you just kind of wish him all the best, and we're proud to have him.
Right, John Duggan's here with us, as you can see. John, how are you?
Ger and Owen, good morning.
You had a great Cheltenham, right?
Generally I do.
Shut up.
A good Cheltenham.
I had a terrible Cheltenham. Owen had an okay Cheltenham.
Even why don't you listen to me?
I lost pretty much of my food allotment for the week.
You recovered, you couldn't eat for a month. You look like you've regained your strength.
I had a bad first day and basically had no money left to win it back over the course of the rest of the week. So entry is an opportunity. Entry and Punchdown are the final few opportunities for the National Hunt Lovers of the Year to get their teeth stuck into some good quality racing. And it's good quality racing today.
It is, yeah. The fact that it's truncated into 3 days as well. You don't have a dud day. I think Cheltenham on the Thursday can be a little bit weak and also weak for your pocket.
Oh, disaster.
Yeah, it's just the Thursday. And I've been looking at the Gold Cup winner to get me out of jail. But it's just as I think JB McManus once said, like, there's always another day in racing, you know. So even if you had a bad Cheltenham, there's Aintree, there's Punchestown, there's Ferry House as well. So, you know, there's always a reason to be optimistic about a great, you know, card at Aintree today. The Grand National Median, of course, the big race on Saturday at 5:15, the most famous race we all watch as kids, and really like top racing today. We've got four Grade One contests. Probably the feature is the Aintree Hurdle at 3:25. Ruby Walsh and Faheen Mellon second in the champion hurdle. Bouverdere, former champion hurdle winner who fell at Cheltenham. All these household names regarding horse racing. So there's nine in the field. That's like probably the biggest race. And then there's another really good race as well, the Betway Bowl at 2:50. You got Clandais Obo, the King George winner. Elegant Escape, the Welsh National winner. And then a couple of Irish horses that are really well fancied. Kenboy, Ruby Walsh, a lot of money for him this morning into 9-4. Road to Respect for Noel Mead, a winner of a big race at Leopardstown a while back, in Bristol Demai, who was third in the Gold Cup. So this is just great stuff.
Yeah, okay. Band of Outlaws is running for Joseph O'Brien.
That's right, yeah.
Juvenile Hurdle.
We got the race over the actual national fences. We got a taste of what the ground is like, and you know, and all the carnage that you get in this. And it's obviously a lot safer, the fences, now than they used to be. But 27 runners in the Fox Hunters Chase, that'll be fun.
Yeah. So I'm staying away from that one. Are you getting involved in anything today, or is
I'm doing a bit of lane, which is a kind of maybe a specialist thing that I don't know if people understand for the audience, but where you actually go onto an exchange and you take bets, so you actually oppose an outcome. So, you know, there might be a horse at 10-1, you might take a tenner on that. You be the bookmaker, effectively. You take the tenner on it. Now, if the horse wins, you owe 100 quid, but you know, if any other horse wins, it doesn't matter which other horse wins,
you get the
tenner minus commission. It's an exchange between backer and layer. I'll be doing a bit of that at Aintree today with horses I don't fancy, because there's horses I don't fancy here, but obviously that's not what the listeners want or the audience want today.
Just as a matter of interest, who are you opposing?
I'm opposing Spirit of the Games in the first race, because I don't think he's got the class to win. I'm opposing Super Sunday, because I think he's gone off the boil in that Aintree hurdle. And I could get caught, and I could be coming in here broke and lost all the Cheltenham stuff. But generally, I'll be quite selective. Elegant Escape doesn't have the class for me to win the... So, as I said before, when we've talked racing, a process of elimination. And if you see something that stands out, then you generally feel, you know what? If it stands out for you, then you know it's probably worth the bet. And even if it stands out for you in a 27-runner race, it might be worth an each-way bet.
Okay.
So what does stand out for me today? In the 5:15, this is the last race, Minella Melody. Minella Melody. Henry de Bromhead had a Minella that won at Cheltenham for Rachel Blackmore at 50-1. This race, though, has produced this favourite. Patrick Mullins rides, a friend of Off the Ball, 11-4, Minella Melody, really highly regarded in the point-to-point ranks, one or two races very easily, and I think she could be something special. On the ratings, she's highly ahead of these on the ratings with the rating post conduct. So Minella Melody, I think, has got a big chance in that mare's race at the 5:15, and a couple of each-way bets in that Fox Hunters. Road to Riches was third in the Gold Cup a few years ago. of course, he's an older horse now. He is not as good as he was, but if he showed some of his old sparkle, he was sixth in the Grand National last year. This is a race of horses. A lot of them are older horses. A lot of them have kind of transferred out of ownership. Road to Riches used to be owned by Michael O'Leary, now owned by somebody else. I think David Maxwell, who actually rides the horse. He's 25-1 Road to Riches. I thought he was one that stood out each way in the Fox Hunters Chase. And also, Paul Nichols, who's kind of back to form in the last few years, has got Diego de Charmille, the top one, in the 2 mile Red Rum Handicap Chase at 8-1. I think he's a cracking each way bet to nothing. He won a grade one race over course and distance at the festival at Aintree last year. He's been very fresh. He's been put away for this. Now, he does have top weight, Diego de Charmille, but I think that I can definitely see him reaching the frame because I think he's got a lot of class.
And what kind of price? Sorry, that goes to post of 440. What's
8-1.
Okay.
8-1 each way. Road to Riches each way. Manila Melody to win. The other races, the big races, I think Bouverdere will probably win the Aintree hurdle. I'm looking at Kemboy. I think the money is significant and that Ruby rides. Ruby hasn't ridden a horse in quite a long time. You know, Bristol Demai can be in and out. Clan des Oboe might be going better right-handed. In the other races, the Juvenile Hurdle, Band of Outlaws, Pentland Hills. Like, you know, it's hard to choose between them. I'm generally wary of four-year-old races, the juvenile races. Sometimes the form, you can get funny results at Aintree after Cheltenham. It doesn't always translate. And the opening race, Le Bagawa, that one for Warren Grey Tricks at Leopardstown. Great jumper. She'll try and jump them into submission. But there's some good horses in the race as well. Kalashnikov, Mengli Khan, who Johnny Ward doesn't really like. But if it's a going day, he could be an each way bet at 8-1. Glenn Forza. Not a race I want to have a bet in. So the ones that, you know, I've suggested are the ones to have a bet in. But what I'll do is I'll do a blog and I'll put it up on offtheball.com.
Okay, so there is definitely some lessons to be learned from people who recognise a horse that they backed at Cheltenham and then they're like, okay, I'm going to ride it out with this true Aintree and Punchestown. Not the case. Don't just back on the fact that some horses are produced for Cheltenham.
Exactly.
Others are actually produced for this because they've had a setback earlier in the season. You go, okay, we're not going to try and make Cheltenham our be-all and end-all because we know we're not going to be ready for it. Sometimes it can just be a preparation run. Although it's Cheltenham and that sounds stupid, but it does happen in some cases.
Yeah, so Kemboy fell at the first in the Gold Cup. So you can completely wipe that out. So that what means Kemboy is a fresher horse than he would have been if he'd run in the Gold Cup over 3.25 miles, maybe finished fourth or fifth, right, on soft ground. Also, the tracks are very different. Cheltenham is undulating, hilly track. Aintree is a flat, speedy track. So Le Bagawa, the trainer Warren Greytrex, thinks this horse is not suited to Cheltenham. I'm going to put her away for Aintree. That, to me, is a significant positive in her favour. Also, the form. She beat top of the game in Santini at Kempton at Christmas. They both were first and second at Cheltenham. That's a very positive sign for her chances at about 7-4. Le Bagawa, whether the distance...
Very short, isn't it?
It is short. But, you know, like, once again, we're speaking to people on Off the Ball on Friday Night Racing all through the year about peaking for Cheltenham. So if you're seeing horses that have bypassed the festival, that's all, sometimes a very positive sign. But also, you don't know what the mark has been left by Cheltenham on certain horses. And that's why I want to be a little bit cautious on the first day of Aintree, see how the results pan out. And that's why I'm kind of interested in horses like that horse at the end race, Manila Melody, who would have bypassed this and would have been aimed at this mare's race. Also, Diego de Charmille did not run at Cheltenham.
All right, John, good stuff. That blog going up on Off the Ball a little bit later on. Owen, are you doing your tipster tip of the tipsters poll of poster, Frank Luntz?
Well, considering I haven't eaten in a month, no. I'm just going to follow John Duggan this week.
No, we're not asking, expecting you to gamble, just to do the work. That's all. People
just do the work on.
Yeah, you know, you've set a very high bar for yourself.
Chris Cook had a good Cheltenham. I have the Guardian in front of me. I wonder, does he have anything in here? I'm saying that now out on a limb that he might do. You'd imagine that the Guardian would be covering Aintree.
Nobody else did that. I didn't see that anywhere else.
So Greg Woods, I meant to say. His tips today, Glenn Forza, Band of Outlaws, Clan des Oboe as his Napa today, Bouverdere, Road to Rome, Lady Buttons as his next best, and Manila Melody.
Well,
we've got a tipster table going on. Manila Melody.
We've got a match.
I'm going to eat this week.
John, I think everybody knows you're a Spurs fan.
Yes. kind of, you know, wishing I wasn't here this morning in ways, having looked in that fireworks display and everything, and just looked amazing. I just can't, I'm going to go to the West Ham game at the end of the month, but it just looks fantastic. It's a stadium fitting for a club that has high ambitions. Now, whether they can align the delivery of that beautiful stadium with like transfer fees and spending money and keeping their manager is probably the next question at Spurs.
Well, talk to us purely as a fan about the last decade and the Levy stewardship. Obviously, Joe Lewis is the owner. And somehow is never involved in the thinking.
He lets Levy get on with it.
Yeah, and yeah. So the fans don't ever think of him as...
No, they don't. It's a strange one. Like, I mean, like,
not the Glazers. He's not Fenway. He's not...
No, like, he's not. He's, you know, he's an elderly man now. He's in his 80s, living out in the Caribbean. You know, but like, I think it's a partnership, really. I wouldn't say that, you know, he's a gardener, Daniel Levy, for Joe Lewis. It is a partnership. It's been a long time now. I was actually going through, bizarrely, you asked that question, I was going through the ownership of Tottenham over the years. It was bought out from a family by Irvine Scholar in the 1980s. It was the first club in football to be put on the stock exchange.
Right.
In about 1983.
By?
Irvine Scholar.
Okay.
Who nearly got Alex Ferguson. He was that close to getting Alex Ferguson to join Tottenham in 1984. And the deal collapsed. And then the history changed and, you know, the rest is history. Then Alan Sugar had it from about 1991 to 2001. So Enoch, which is Levy and Lewis, they've been there for quite a while. They were also had an interest in Rangers at the time. But they've been there quite a while now. And you have to say, Daniel Levy is a hard-nosed businessman, but he's done a great job. Now, the only thing that's lacking is trophies.
Is that the view of the Spurs fans?
I think so. You know, there has been frustrations over the years. There's been frustrations with, when are we ever going to get out of this rush that we've been in? But we've seen definite progression. We saw us get into the Champions League under Harry Redknapp. We've seen a really good appointment with Pochettino. We see this brand new stadium. I'm just hoping that, I know it cost £1 billion, but like, it just seems from a revenue point of view, very, very progressive with the NFL situation, with a retractable pitch. £100 million, I think they're going to get in gate receipts every season. So you have to just look at, I mean, we'd be going to Wild Lane, we'd love the character of the place, but, you know, pillars in the way, 36,000.
Yeah.
It's not fit for purpose for an elite club that wants to compete in a European or a Champions League setting. So I'm very excited about it. I'm just hoping that now the investment, that he loosens the purse strings a bit regarding transfers, keeping the manager, and also, you know, the huge thing is wage structure. Like, for a player like Christian Eriksen, who could walk in, I think, to any team in Europe, that he's retained. London's a great place to live. But yeah, I just think with the shakes with City, with Liverpool, with Man United, having seen bottomless pit because of the global brand they are. Spurs have the aim to be a global brand. The stadium now reflects that, but they're not there yet. I don't think in the world psyche is a global brand.
While that was happening last night, Gareth Bale was sitting on his ass on the bench for Real Madrid. That would be one hell of a way to shatter the supporters' expectations when it comes to playing players' wages. And it will completely shatter the ceiling with which Spurs tend to reach and go no further. That would be the one sign, and keep everybody else, get Gareth Bale back to Tottenham Hotspur in his shiny new stadium and go for the Premier League title next season.
Yeah, it'd be great. Whether you should go back is another thing. That would be great. I don't know if that's going to happen. I think that a lot of people were speaking about, like, it's funny that the job has been filled now at Old Trafford and at the Bernabeu, where Pochettino was meant to be going. So
still, he hasn't committed to next season yet.
No, because I think he's frustrated. He's frustrated at, like, everybody, you know, like, what he knows he's good, right? He knows he's doing everything he can. And they're in the Champions League quarterfinals. I think they will rattle City in some way. I don't know whether they'll beat them over two legs, but I think they'll rattle them. I knew last night, and you're talking about laying bets, the first thing I did at 7:40 was I laid the hell out of Crystal Palace. Because I knew when I saw the pictures, Tottenham, there's no way in hell they're going to lose this game. It looked magnificent. And like, even like, you're like this cashless stadium, you can't use cash at the stadium. The longest bar in Europe.
Cheese room that didn't quite make the cut.
No, but
apparently
they ran out of cheese in the press room, which was funny. For all those insiders. But the beer that they serve from the bottom, I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They have them in Anfield.
Oh, do they?
Yeah, it was in Anfield like 3 weeks ago. And then this thing is like, oh, look at this amazing thing they have in the Spurs Stadium. Like, well, they have it in Anfield.
Yeah. But as a fan, I'm so excited. I can't wait to go. And it is, it's just exciting times. I just hope it's matched on the pitch.
I do wonder if the right thing to do is to break the wage structure, or if actually the right thing to do is to continue what they're doing and hope that everybody comes back and the financial fair play finally eventually kicks in. And so you are a properly run club who is continuing to do the right thing. It's not as much fun to be a fan of that team, but ultimately it's like progressive, intelligent design of your side, where you base it around good quality pickups from the lower divisions, like the Dele
Alli's. Your own academy as well. Yeah. Dele Alli was, you know, David Pleat spotted him in Milton Keynes. He could have gone to Liverpool, didn't, and they got him in. Like Harry Kane, the way he's been developed under Poch. Yeah, the only thing about Spurs is like you're always waiting for the disappointment. And yeah. It's 33 years of disappointments, and like even like last Sunday, I was throwing out the TV out the window on Twitter. So now I'm talking with huge childlike exuberance and enthusiasm. So it's a weekly review.
Yeah, it's fair enough. But it should be the roller coaster of watching football. John, good stuff. We're going to play this video and then we're going to come back with Donal and Neil. The Galway captain, Sarah Dervin, joined Off the Ball last night to talk about building belief in the squad and beating Kilkenny to the league final. Have a look.
I suppose, like, last year, Kilkenny beat us three times and, you know, we were always getting to semi-finals and stuff like that, but not breaking through to the final. And I suppose that's where we found, like, we know we're good camogie players, and I suppose we just didn't maybe believe in ourselves a bit, that we had the capability of actually competing with the top two teams of Kilkenny and Cork in them. And it was just, for us, for the league now, it was kind of just trying to build a bit of confidence in ourselves and kind of grow for championship.
The defensive record right across the league has been really strong. I think the weekend Kilkenny's 2-8 is the most you've conceded. I think Cork managed, was it, they put 13 points on as well. But other than that, it seems like defensively Galway are a really tight-knit unit.
Yeah, like we're a good side. Like now look, Kilkenny got the two goals that we're going to have to unfortunately look back and understand what actually happened, because they weren't, they were sloppy goals on our behalf. Like, so I don't think we're fine-tuned yet. We still have a lot of work to do. But look, we have 11 weeks to the first round of the championship against Kilkenny. So, you know, we have to drive on now from that. Like, we can't really accept the two goals that went in either.
Yeah. It's Sarah Dervin there from Galway talking about their league win. You can get the rest of that available wherever you get your podcasts. It's offtheball.com is probably the best place for them at the moment. Offtheball.com/podcasts. Now, just a brief talking point that came up earlier on with Kieran Donaghy on this week's Shot Clock, where he was suggesting that Sean O'Shea might have a future at midfield. Obviously, Mayo cleaning Kerry out at midfield was a theme of the two games, according to you. Sean O'Shea would obviously... He's one of the best footballers in the country at the minute, certainly according to our power rankings. And maybe you do want him on the ball 30 times a game as opposed to 15 times a game.
Away from goal.
But what if he's like... getting towards goal.
What happens if Kerry come up against Mayo in the summer and Sean O'Shea is at midfield? Mayo put Lee Keegan on Sean O'Shea in midfield and Lee Keegan is closer to your own goals. It's shooting yourself in the foot. There's like, David Moran will be back this summer. He will be starting. Maybe it's something that they can look at down the line. I just think that Sean O'Shea just needs a bit more experience in terms of actually figuring out that matchup with Lee Keegan. It's going to happen again at some point, and granted, if it happens tomorrow, again, Lee Keegan will still get the better of him. It's just the way they are, and that is the way a lot of those individual matchups are going to go, and you can't really legislate for a player getting the better of somebody else. Like, I mean, Keegan is an absolute master at that. He did it to Dermot Connolly as well. Like, it's no disrespect to Sean O'Shea. I just don't think he's...
Is that the case, though? Is if they play midfield... Do Mayo not go, Grant, we'll stick Keegan on Clifford and then Clifford has nothing in the game?
Maybe.
Is
Clifford too close to goals to actually for Lee Keegan to actually do damage to the other end? I don't know. Marking an inside forward isn't something that Lee Keegan tends to do, as far as I recall. It always tends to be a half forward. It always allows Keegan to get that sort of scope. I mean, the only time they've obviously dropped somebody back to the full back line in dramatic positional switches has been Aidan O'Shea. And I wouldn't rule that out again either in terms of potentially stopping Tommy Walsh if he managed to kind of kick on again this summer. But I don't know. I don't buy this. It might be worth trying out in Cusick Park in the first round of the Munster Championship and seeing how he goes. And I might be completely wrong. It might go magnificently well for Kerry, but I just don't see that being an option against one of the better teams.
Explain the rationale behind why it might work. Given that you're so against it, explain to me the other case.
Well, it's what you just said. He's an unbelievable footballer. Having him on the ball more might be a better version. And one of the things that perhaps he doesn't get enough credit for is his distribution and his kick passing and his creative play in a deeper role, being able to kickstart attacks from that and getting a more mobile half forward line in action might actually be a positive on that front. But in terms of high fielding, in terms of being able to battle in midfield, I just see him definitely below David Moore in that respect. I still think.
But so, you're not asking him to do the same job. It's a complementary midfield partnership as opposed to two people are the same, right?
Mm-hmm. So that was his entire point, wasn't it? Yeah. That Jack Barry and Dermot O'Connor are too similar. Yeah, maybe that is. Maybe that is what you look at. Like, but they did try that with Mark Griffin in the league, a little and large, or a different type of midfielder, a ball runner, and it didn't tend to work. Now, Sean O'Shea is different again.
Yeah, so that's the point, isn't it? That, like, if you've come up twice now against this opposition who are absolutely killing you with what you're currently doing, it'd be interesting to see what would happen if David Moore was there. But we don't know how fit David Moore is going to be, at what point he's going to reach his peak level of fitness. And hopefully it's sooner rather than later. But let's for a moment just park the fact that he might not be available or might not reach his optimum fitness in time for a Mayo game. You've got to think of something different, right? You've got to think of something different, because keep doing the same stuff, expecting a different outcome, definition of insanity.
Yeah. I thought they were quite slow to introduce Gavin O'Brien at the weekend, who I thought was really, really good, say, in the Dublin game, managed to catch a few clean balls, and is somebody that perhaps wasn't utilised as quickly as he could have been at the weekend. I just think that Sean O'Shea at 11 has looked, it just looked like that number jersey was made for him this year. Like, I'm not exactly saying that he's going to be a terrible midfielder. As you say, he's one of the best footballers in the country. It's not going to.
And think of the impact that the best midfielder are having on the Dublin team. Like, who is the definite number 11 in Dublin, really? Is Kieran Kilkenny, even though he started loads of games last year at 14, they seem to think that position is so interchangeable that anybody along that half-forward line, Conor Callan can play there, you can bring Kilkenny out there. Like, there are various stages when you haven't a clue who's playing 11, but your midfield is the starting point for everything.
Yeah, and I'm kind of, just to entertain your idea here, or Kieran's idea, like the knock-on of that as well is you can experiment with 11 as well. I would love to have seen James O'Donoghue playing at centre-half forward at some point over the past couple of years. Now, the question is whether or not we'll ever see the old James O'Donoghue again. The evidence may be that we won't, but maybe playing at 11 will actually kind of kickstart his career in a different direction. Like, we've got to accept that he's been ravaged with injury more than any other player on that team over the past few years. Maybe he's going to reach his peak a lot sooner than other footballers, and maybe they need to start looking at him like they started to look at Gooch after 2011, going into the 2013 season especially. And maybe that's the outlet for him. But I remember he was in the studio last year saying that that's not something he's ever considered or something that they would consider doing.
That's not what he said. He said that absolutely he would play there and he'd love to.
Did he?
Yeah, that was. We definitely came away from that. Well, we've come away from it with a different sense. Like, yeah, like, I totally understand exactly what the inside forwards want from ball coming through. And so therefore, if I was getting on ball, I would understand exactly.
Or maybe
what
he said that it's not going to happen this year or something. I definitely remember coming away from that piece thinking to myself, we're not going to see James O'Donoghue at 11. And certainly not this year. That's what I. Maybe I switched off and maybe I didn't listen to him properly, but that's the knock-on effect of that. I just think once David Moore comes back in, it's who partners him. Is Sean O'Shea the correct person to do so?
Well, I mean, that would be a pretty amazing partnership, wouldn't it? Like, and then you've got reinforcements from the bench who are like top quality, and if you need to, you can move. You then have like a chess piece situation where the opposition hasn't a clue what you're going to do. Whereas if you've got the same prototype midfielders, the opposition are looking at those two going, okay, we see what you can do. We know exactly how you're going to try and attack us. We know your defensive strengths. Yeah, we got that. Whereas if you stick that in, if you stick this free radical in, who's like, I mean, I'm sorry, but you're like, no, this can never happen. Got to do it, you know?
Well, I'm starting to see some of the benefits here. I'm not going to lie, it will be exciting, because it will be exciting, but I just think on a purely practical level, the way Kerry got bullied in midfield over the last couple of games, I think...
What if you can't catch the guy to bully him? What if he's like slaloming around you, humiliating you? What if that happens?
Yeah, he didn't exactly slalom around Lee Keegan at the weekend. I mean,
no, because there's no space.
The thing is, now they've found that. Like, they've found what could potentially be his kryptonite. Like, I mean, when Kerry come up against Brian Fenton, they managed to put Jack Barry on him, and it seems to be the thing that he does best is mark Brian Fenton. Sometimes that just happens, and maybe if those two teams were to come up against each other in the summer, it's a different story.
And if would they put Lee Keegan in midfield?
Yes.
Would they? Definitely.
If they know that he is going to be marking Sean O'Shea, they definitely would. I just don't see any reason why James Horne, next time they come up against him, isn't putting Lee Keegan on Sean O'Shea. A very specific job, one of their best players. It's a win. And it was a huge factor in them winning the game last week.
Yeah. I don't know. The stuff to the conundrum of what to do with Lee Keegan when he's so amazing. Like, is he the greatest creative player of all time that we've just never seen being given the license to, because he's also the best defensive man marker this side of the Tyrone 0-3 team?
Maybe, I don't know. I just don't, like, when you mean creative, you mean him in the forwards, is it? Or you mean
yeah,
him?
Yeah, what if he was like
free of a man marking role?
Yeah, what if he was the best centre forward that we've never seen?
He could be. He certainly got the running game to attack from deep. Kind of a deep lying number 11. I'd like to see that. Or if there was a Lee Keegan on another team, a six that likes to attack from deep,
yeah,
put Lee Keegan on that person. The thing is, like, could you put Lee Keegan on Jack McCaffrey, for example?
Well, where would he play if he was playing for the Dubs?
Wing back.
It would be, wouldn't it?
Wing back, yeah.
Yeah, and you'd be getting him on, and you'd be like saying, you don't worry about marking, I've got Brian Howard to do that, or whoever is like the 21-year-old who's willing to accept his role on the team until he realises he's actually a superstar. Some guy from the under-20s that you've never heard of before is like, oh, actually this guy's a superstar, but he doesn't know it yet, so we can make him do all the defensive work. And then you just stick Lee Keegan in the half-back line, whose job it is to bomb forward.
It works
in a race, which is basically Jack McCaffrey's job at the minute.
Yeah.
With a bit more defence thrown in.
Like, I don't think we actually appreciate the defensive prowess of Jack McCaffrey because he's so good at the other side of the ball. But
and also it got way better last year. Definitely huge progress. So we're basically saying he's Jack McCaffrey.
The conclusion here is that we want to see Lee Keegan at 11, we want to see James O'Donoghue at 11, and we want to see Sean O'Shea at midfield. I've come away from this a little bit more encouraged about the prospect, but I'm still saying it's not the right option in a big game. May as well try it against Kerry.
Alright, so it went from no, this is terrible to, oh, actually I'm very excited about this, to, yeah, I want to see it. That was a good quick turnaround. Way to hold your position there.
There's plenty of movies that I've wanted to see that have ended up being crap. Like, it just looks good on paper, or it looks like an exciting combination. This might be one of those things.
All right. On that note, that is all from us on OTB AM this morning. We're back tomorrow morning from 7:45. Alan Quinlan, Aintree recap from today, and look forward to the Grand National with John Duggan. We'll also bring you our piece with Donal O'Neill as well. The Hurling Show is live today across Off the Ball on all our social channels from 3 o'clock. Conor Murray and John Giles tonight together on Off the Ball with Nathan from 7 o'clock. But that is your lot today. Remember, you can subscribe to all our podcasts on whatever podcast app you're using. Best place to get all your podcasts from us is offtheball.com/podcasts. Also, a reminder too to subscribe to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/offtheball. If you hit subscribe on that, then we'll ping you a little notification anytime we're live and you'll never miss a thing. All top quality content for free. See you tomorrow. Good luck. So if you like this, you'll probably also like OTB AM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream or catch the show live on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook or offtheball.com every morning from 7:45 AM.